Because once again, Bertha is boring, which is good news unless you're rooting against her. Who would do that? Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. My guests are Seattle Times opinion columnist Jonathan Martin. Jonathan?
Hey, yeah.
Q13 Fox political analyst C.R. Douglas. Hi, C.R.
Good morning.
Seattle Channel's host of Civic Cocktail, Joni Balter. Hiya, Joni.
Good morning.
I'll start with you. Joni, Bertha started tunneling again this week, if you can call that tunneling. Briefly, what happened?
She rammed through this concrete wall into the safety of the rescue pit, as it is referred to. And did anybody watch the video?
Oh, yes. That was quite fun.
Yeah. So, you know,
CR, did you see the little
video? I actually didn't. I'm the one here from TV, and I didn't see the video.
Okay. You know, those TV guys, you know. But anyway, so she bursts through, the cloud of smoke goes up, and it's like this day of celebration. This machine did what it was supposed to do. It's like people applauding me for going to work. Thanks.
Right, but that seems like a reversal.
Well, it is a reversal. I mean, the thing hasn't basically moved for, over a year. I mean, it is a small victory, an important victory, but there is still a war between this machine and the soil that has not been won. They are banking on the fact that replacing the cutter and ball bearing, basically the front of the machine, is going to do the trick. But there's a whole bunch of reasons to be skeptical. This first 1,000 feet was the worst imaginable journey you can sort of contemplate. I mean, they hit every roadblock.
They say it gets better from here if she gets fixed, that the soil gets easier to dig through when you're lower down.
The two things they're counting on is that the cutter head, the new one, is a heavier, dutier one. And secondly, that the soil gets better going forward. But this is all they have. If this does not work, there will be no tunnel.
And when do we find out? When do they start?
We find out once they fix the cutter head and then try to resume digging. And you do know, this is going ahead a little bit, if they do fix it and it resumes digging, this becomes a non-story that we talk about how the lawyers are getting along, right?
That was my point. Basically, it's like grabbing a box of popcorn and watching a movie right now. I said this last time I was on. This is a design-build contract. The state paid a bunch of very rich companies to get us a tunnel. They've screwed it up so far. And I'm just very anxious to see what these very smart engineering companies are going to do to deliver us our tunnel. Until they can come up with a solution that actually works, at this point, taxpayers are on the sideline. There's no evidence that we're going to have to pay more for this. There's no evidence other than that we're going to have this thing 2 years late at least. But at this point, it's all premature to say what's going to come next. What's going to come next is Seattle Tunnel Partners owes us a tunnel.
When do they start lifting and fixing?
Well, they start lifting very quickly, but the fix takes several
months.
They hope to start drilling again in the summer.
Late summer.
Which is a different date than they had said before, to be fair.
Yes.
The date is like, it's very elastic, that date. But to add to your point there, Jonathan, you know, these are big companies, Hitachi Zosen, Tudor Perini, if I'm saying this right, and I have worked at that, and Andragados. These are big companies. If they don't succeed here, they have to succeed here or else is kind of the way to say that about their reputation.
Well, and there's contract provisions that are built in. There's if they're late, they owe penalties. They have a $500 million bond riding on this.
But there's only about $140 million left to kind of chew on.
Okay, I'm getting bogged down in fill right now. I just hit a pipe. Yes, see.
There is inspiration for this fix. Basically, the same thing happened 20 years ago in Canada. They were building a tunnel. A similar machine, smaller but similar, got stuck, dirt got in it, soil got mixed up in the seals. They had to dig a pit exactly like this. They replaced that front end of the machine, and bang, it resumed and finished the tunnel. They are doing everything they did in Canada, and hopefully the same story plays out.
Which, by the way, Bertha breaking through into the daylight is not good news if you oppose this thing to begin with, which, remember, to some people, this is an extravagant, unnecessary, misguided sop to fossil fuels that will make traffic worse. So this isn't a triumphant day for
I'm caught in a time machine here. It sounds like we're having that. Like we're repeating the weekend review show from about 5 years ago.
For example, though,
decision's been made.
This week, legislators from Eastern Washington, Republican Senator Mike Baumgartner of Spokane specifically, introduced a measure not 5 years ago, but in the future, that would keep any new gas tax revenue from going to pay for the tunnel project. He said, "It's not fair for any other taxpayers to have to pay gas tax for basically what is a vanity project in downtown Seattle to replace a perfectly good viaduct that could have been fixed for a fraction of the cost." Now, isn't he right on that score that we could have done this more cheaply, but we want a beautiful Puget Sound view that doesn't help Spokane at all, doesn't move goods to the eastern part of the state?
Well, let's review what he's talking about. This is a state roadway. 60% of the traffic on the existing viaduct passes through Seattle. It does not get off at an exit. It is an important route for the whole state.
Yeah, but it would have been just as important if we'd done it on the cheap.
Well, if we'd done it on the cheap, that was the baling wire and the duct tape on the viaduct that no one thought was really a solution in the next earthquake. We are talking about a viaduct that's sinking. How many inches?
Wasn't there a surface street option and
yes,
a trench instead of a tunnel?
But it didn't work. And so these folks are sort of fixated. Mike Baumgartner seems fixated on it. He's so afraid that there'll be cost overruns. I should point out, this is a guy who ran for U.S. Senate a few years ago, 39%. In his race there, this is his second attempt to sort of rail on this Seattle project.
Right.
What gives?
Well, there is a sense among people in Olympia, a sentiment, not just Baumgartner, but it's wider share than just him, that this is not a state project, it is a Seattle project. And that goes back to the birth of this thing. There was a big debate over what alternative. And remember, Gregoire wanted not chicken wire, but another elevated structure, rebuild the thing, like the existing viaduct, but bigger and bulkier. Greg Nichols wanted a tunnel. They were at odds. That was a huge, intense fight. I will spare you the narrative, but bottom line, Seattle won. Seattle got its tunnel, and it was the more expensive option. And it was considered a luxury by many lawmakers in Olympia, and that's the sentiment that's driving Baumgartner. It says, hey, if this thing needs more money, Seattle, you wanted it, you pay.
Last word, Jonathan Martin.
Seattle did pay for part of it, but really what you have with Michael Baumgartner is this stick-it-to-Seattle ethos in Olympia. If it weren't Bertha, it would be something else that Michael Baumgartner and the Tea Party fringe down there would love to just, stick it to Seattle. So it's not a serious proposal from not a serious legislator.
You know who's not overly concerned about any of this? The guy you met in the green room 10 minutes ago. Carl LeCompte is going to be joining us in a few minutes. He's a Bellevue man, a Microsoft programmer, who might be on the first human colonization trip to Mars. And by the way, that is a one-way ticket. And he is applying for it. And he's made it to the next round. He's on the short list. And we're going to talk to him. We want to know, what would you like to ask the man who might be about to be one of the first colonizers of Mars? So you can let us know at KUOW on Twitter, at KUOW, or you can post them to our Facebook page, KUOW Public Radio, and we'll relay our favorite questions to the man himself in just a few minutes. This is KUOW's Week in Review, and in a moment, Carl LeCompte is also not concerned about who a florist gets to provide flowers for, because he's got higher concerns. But for the rest of us, this is a big deal and a fascinating debate and a judge's ruling this week, and we'll be right back with it. Stay tuned. Okay, this is why we take these little breaks in between topics, so that we can gab off mic. And what I'm loving is how everybody watched that video and saw something different. Because this is the video. We're back to Bertha for just a moment. Bear with me. But so the DOT posted the video of the tunnel machine breaking into the rescue pit. I saw childbirth.
You have three children.
I have three kids. I've been there. I have been there. A bunch of men standing around uselessly watching this wall become 90% dilated. And this is, you know, I'm talking to a coworker who's like, oh, come on. I said, what? How can you not think childbirth? And it turns out everybody saw something different.
Well, I didn't exactly see the childbirth there, but I'm with you. On that, I'm supporting you, shall we say.
I'm not
ready
being
to
gross,
catch,
right?
You know, yeah.
Right.
No.
Ready to catch it. It crowned.
Well, the joke in our newsroom was that it's transportation porn. A bunch of men standing around very excited about watching a live feed or something.
Wow. Okay, so it does get more disturbing. I know as a taxpayer, I was feeling the contractions. I was feeling every cost overrun. I wanted the epidural. Just show me the project when it's all cleaned up.
A lot of people say, wake me when it starts moving. You know, wake me when this whole thing ends.
Okay, back on our agenda now, which, by the way, is running down the top news of the week. So you can learn and understand and go and talk about it this weekend, smart-like. We're with Jonathan Martin, opinion columnist at the Seattle Times, C.R. Douglas, political analyst at Q13 Fox, and from the Seattle Channel and Bloomberg View, Joni Balter. Now, where were we before we sidetracked? Before we're going, Bertha is trying to go forward and we're going backward. Okay, the next top story this week, the city of Seattle is, we'll get into that in a moment. Let's talk about this florist I mentioned. I'm going to tell you a story. This is a true story. So there's a gay couple in Richland, Washington, Robert and Kurt, who have been using the same florist for years, 10 years. In 2012, we, the voters of Washington, approve same-sex marriage. So Robert walks in to his florist to order some flowers, this time for his wedding. And the florist, 70-year-old Southern Baptist, takes his hands in hers and says, oh, Rob, I can't do that because of my relationship with Jesus. Nice enough woman, but the couple doesn't want to let it go. So they sue her for $7.91. The cost, apparently the cost of that's a lot of gas, but their gas and inconvenience for having to go to, you know, down to another flower shop who will do their wedding. So this week, a Benton County judge rules that that florist violated state consumer protection and anti-discrimination law, and the state attorney general offered to settle the case if she pays a $2,000 penalty and $1 in legal fees and promises to provide flowers for same-sex weddings from now on. Plus, she presumably has her legal bills. Does that sound fair?
Well, I think it sounds like the attorney general is saying, I'm trying to teach a lesson here. I am not trying to put you out of business, which I think a lot of people watching this would agree with the judge's ruling, but then have this sort of pitter-patter. They don't want to put this person out of business. They just want her to learn the laws of Washington.
The First Amendment protection here, you can think whatever you want, you can believe whatever you want, but it's when your actions take a discriminatory bent based on your beliefs is the problem.
Right. Then your religion is no defense.
Right. And in this case, I think this woman totally did this couple a favor by saying outright what her bigotry was. You know, we know that the history of retail commerce is full of microaggressions against people who are ethnic minorities or gay or lesbian. You know, President Obama talked about this himself, being tailed through stores because he was a young black man. So this woman did us a favor. She said, here's why I did it. It presented a very clear-cut case where the constitutional protections for religion meet up with the anti-discrimination code. So I think it was the right decision, and I think that this was a message sender as we move forward in gay marriage.
I mean, it was the most predictable and expected decision in a long time. I mean, you can't, on the one hand, have laws that say you can't discriminate against gays and lesbians. We're giving them civil rights protections and then marriage protections. I mean, all the things that the legislature has passed in the several years. And then, on the other hand, say, but we're going to allow discrimination. I mean, imagine that an interracial couple went to this florist and said, hey, do our wedding. And she says, well, it's against my religion. I mean, we would absolutely not accept that, right? I mean, and that's the principle here. I mean, once you sort of put a new class under the non-discrimination clauses, in this case, sexual orientation that has been put there the last several years, then you treat those people the same as you treated the others that are already there. I mean, race, religion, ethnicity, all the rest. We wouldn't allow discrimination against miscegenation. We're not allowing it now against gays and lesbians.
this couple, the price they put on her discrimination was $7.91. First, does $2,000 seem fair? And should the state take into any account how offended or put out this couple felt by their 10-year-long florist?
I think if the AG pursued a more vigorous penalty, you risk a backlash. This is part of a long social movement that's gained tremendous traction. As CR said, it's been an incremental approach. You lay the hammer down the first chance possible and bankrupt a florist, you create a martyr.
Well, the florist lawyer claims that she is now being inundated with wedding requests from same-sex couples and that at $2,000 per violation, she could be bankrupted.
Yeah, but it seems to me that the offer from the attorney general was intended to kind of ramp down the financial hit on these folks while upping the message of the rules and the court ruling.
There are really two suits going on here. I mean, damages for these individuals, which I guess they're pursuing at $7.91. But the state is enforcing its laws. It's enforcing its anti-discrimination laws, its consumer protection laws. I mean, and it, in some ways, it doesn't matter what the couple thinks. And if they feel $7 is enough, when you're enforcing your laws on the books, your standard is not necessarily if those people agree with it. It's what makes sense based on what you've done with past lawsuits in this kind of area.
There's also a court of public opinion that's working here in that, you know, you can talk on your Facebook page or your Twitter feed all you want about the discriminatory practices of this florist, and she might pay a consequence in the marketplace as she might lose business. On the other hand, if gay couples want to use her services as a statement, then she might not. But there is a consequence beyond whatever penalty she pays to the direct lawsuit. She might very well pay something in the marketplace.
I don't know what the situation is in Richland. How do you think you would react if this happened to you in Seattle, where this woman would seem like she wouldn't even want people to know that this was her attitude? You know, she would seem such an insignificant minority that you would go take your business to any place else on the corner.
You know what I'm doing after this show? I'm going to see a florist about my daughter's wedding. And it feels so dizzying to me because there's so many different florists I could pick. And that would be a factor for me if I knew that someone was discriminating.
I mean, it seems unimaginable in Seattle, but let's not forget, this is a large state, and that was a controversial set of laws. The gay civil rights laws, the marriage laws passed, you know, with only a few votes. So I tend to agree with Jonathan that there is a risk of overdoing it here with your penalty, that you do create a martyr and you create a backlash. I mean, people.
It's certainly happening on. I've been bouncing around, right, seeing reactions. And obviously, there are plenty of Christian sites, newspapers, et cetera. This is getting a lot of attention where the. I mean, talk about a, from their point of view, a sympathetic character, this sweet old woman who's been at least acquaintances with this gay couple for years and, you know, feels like this is a. Something that goes against her, everything she believes. There is a backlash out there. I don't know how intense it is. Go on.
Well, and I think you need to bring people along. Mm-hmm. And the country's moving quickly. Mm-hmm. But Richland's a different place than Seattle. And, you know, ultimately, the ideal outcome here is that this woman will, over time, abide by the law, right? That's kind of what everyone wants. And if she just doesn't and can't see fit to do it, well, she has an option. She can get out of the flower business. No one's requiring her to do this. If she wants to play in the public marketplace, your religion doesn't just allow you to sort of do anything. Well, you've got to play.
You know, it's not like it's a subtle connection. Florists do weddings. They do a lot of weddings. That's part of their business. So what you just said, CR, is about right. That if that part of the business is so challenging to her where she lives, then she does have to reconsider the line of work she's in.
You remember, too, that this is not just a belief, an issue based on her beliefs. She has a business license, and as part of getting a business license and having the authority to do business in the state of Washington, is you have to follow Washington state laws. So there's a voluntary act there by her going into business. If she wants to stay home and discriminate against gay people all she wants in the privacy of her living room, spew on the internet, fine. That's not an actionable offense. But when you violate the law, because you've had a business license, then it is.
I mean, non-discrimination trumps religion. And in a civilized society, it has to. It would be chaos if we allowed religion to rule the day and everything.
Speaking of a state rule that no one will feel sorry for you if you don't want to live by it, I'm going to make a segue here.
I'm watching this. I'm going over the Himalayas okay. here with you.
Okay, so you're on your way home.
I'm holding back for a moment. See where Bill's going.
Let's see if his crampons are working.
Where was I? You're on your way home. Traffic is terrible again. You're tired. You're annoyed. What does that sign say? The 520 bridge is closed for boat traffic for up to a half an hour? Has that happened to you? You live on the east side, CR.
It's happened many times.
And you react how?
Well, I evolved on this. At first, it was incredibly frustrating and like, oh, not another closure. I missed it. You know, I could have 5 minutes earlier and I would have bypassed it.
For some wealthy people with the wind in their hair.
But over time, I came to love the closures. Here's why. It was a moment of tranquility, especially if you're close to the closure, not way back in Montlake, but if you were up right in the middle of the span and it closed, there was something very unbelievable about not a sound of a car. All engines had been turned off. And for a few minutes, people are walking outside, taking pictures, sitting on the side of the bridge. It was like a park. It was
forced meditation.
It was. And it was this tranquil moment. It was sort of like the ultimate Snapchat park. It was there.
Pop up.
And then it was gone.
And there's
you have great memories of it.
That's a wonderful reading of the CR. That is so
weirdly missed.
You know, but I know exactly what he's talking about. It is there's something uniquely Seattle, uniquely West Coast about it. It reminds me also of like when the ducks start walking across the street and everybody just stops. And it's a quiet moment. The ducks are going and you're kind of, oh, yeah, whatever. So you just have to slow down and take in the moment.
I bike over the Fremont Bridge all the time on my commute home. And I had a friend of mine who was biking with me. He was like, why don't these boaters have to pay a toll or something to raise the bridge? And I thought about it for a while. It's like, you know what? They could pay a toll. Fine. But it is kind of a beautiful moment. I think CR put it so nicely. It's like it really is a unique sense of place.
I am with some blissed out Northwesterners, man. This is a beautiful thing.
Listen, if you bought it, bought the boat closures, yeah. Your life will be hell for the last year.
No, but you were just thinking about the zipper. I know you.
I know zipper merch.
You just need to get a boat.
Well, this week, either your hell or your bliss is going away because workers working on 520, the new bridge, they closed the draw span. So you've lost your Snapchat moment. The boats have to go out of their way to get under the eastern high rise, which is only a 58-foot clearance, which means the tallest boats,
they have to cut off the top.
They have to cut off their mast. They can't get through. According to Como News, anyway, Paul Allen's yacht Tatoosh, which is moored at his Mercer Island mansion south of the 520 bridge, won't fit under the 58-foot clearance, so his yacht is, if it's there, is stuck in the lake for a year.
Can he go the other way? You know, go around Mercer Island to the East Channel? Does that work?
Well, he just can't get to the locks. Yeah. The point is right. He can just travel around Mercer Island, basically, yeah. for a year. I don't know. They gave a lot of warning to anyone who lives south of that bridge that had a boat over 58 feet. Hey, this is coming up. So
Paul Allen doesn't have an internet connection. How is he supposed to know?
I assume Paul
Not
Allen.
Everybody does,
I assume
CR.
Paul Allen took his boat and pulled it outside and, you know, out of the locks if he wanted to use it for the next year. I did not have a ton of sympathy for the over 58-foot boat
no.
that might be stuck for a year.
You know, I see his boat out on Lake Washington often, and I have a funny feeling that if he wanted to move it, he maybe put it somewhere else, but I can't verify.
Well, eventually it's going to be a 70-foot clearance in about a year, but that's it. I mean, there's no draw span, and there are yachts with taller masts than 70 feet.
And they're being traded in sort of rapidly.
Right. You can get them for a song.
There actually are, but they aren't Paul Allen's, because actually you can't get south of Mercer Island
right.
with over 70 feet. So we basically prevented 70-foot boats for all intents and purposes, on the lake. So this is going to create a span that's equivalent to the East Channel Bridge and will basically allow the same access anyone has that's around Mercer Island.
And you know who's not concerned about that at all?
The Mars guy.
I'm out of segues. That's all I got. In case you just joined us, we are about to meet a man who's on the short list to go to Mars. and never come back. He lives in Bellevue, Microsoft programmer. His name is Carl, and we want to know what you want to know from Carl. Imagine, I mean, a billion questions surely popped up in his head. What about you? You can tweet us at KUOW or post your question to our Facebook page, KUOW Public Radio. We'll be right back on The Week in Review. See, we're still talking about ducks and Snapchats.
Sierra, that was just beautiful.
Thank you.
It was beautiful. Thank you for that moment of zen.
There was something special about, I mean, it was like a community. And then I will end
community.
Here. It was a community that we were sort of all in
for this, a lot of exhaust.
For this moment in time.
John Stewart's leaving. Can we steal moment of zen? Can we have that?
I think it's available.
KUOW's Week in Review with Jonathan Martin, C.R. Douglas, and Joni Balter recapping the top stories of the week, one of which is the city of Seattle losing yet another city council member. Sally Clark is the third member to say she's not running for re-election either. C.R. Douglas, why is a third of the Seattle City Council heading for the exits?
Well, it's unprecedented. Hasn't happened, I'm not sure, ever. Certainly not in my memory or in real recent memory. So when they do this all at once, you have to say, is something going on beyond the sort of idiosyncrasies of each of these candidates? And I believe yes. I mean, what has changed is district elections. And I believe districts is at least part of the reason behind these retirements. Nick Licata.
Very briefly, instead of all citywide council seats, it's split up into districts. And there's two seats are citywide.
That, yeah. Sally Clark
seven,
is up.
Seven district seats, two citywide. Right. I mean, Nick Licata under districts was going to face a popular incumbent if he wanted to run again. Tom Rasmussen under districts was going to face a West Seattle-only electorate, a cranky electorate. They are not happy with, among other things, Bertha and transportation. Tom was going to have to really account for that. He would have actually had an easier time in an at-large race. And Sally Clark, who was running in an at-large race, actually, but those positions actually changed when you only have two as opposed to nine. Anyone wanting to run citywide was going to have to go for one of those two slots. They were going to get more crowded. They were already getting some high-profile challengers. She was going to have a tougher race. They all were going to have a tougher race because of districts. Not that they couldn't have won, but that, I think, changed the calculus for
them. Now, this is all very interesting to city council candidates and the mayor, I'm sure, but why should the rest of us care?
Well, CR is right that the process has changed, but you also have to consider that this city council was quite old. It had been quite stable. It had been there for a long time. Before Shama Sawant was elected, the average age in city council was 61 years old. And this is in a city where the average age is about 35 and dropping by the minute. And you also had a council that had stayed there, been on for a very long time, an unusually long time. So this is great. I think this is terrific. This is changing up the city politics in a way that is going to better reflect what Seattle is now.
Give me an example.
Well, can I just,
what would change?
Can I just disagree with him for a little?
Okay. Yeah, yeah, sure. We encourage
so,
that.
So there are varying degrees of how district elections contributed to these three retirements. It depends on which race you're talking about. But that said, what was the original point of district elections? It's different from what you just said, Jonathan. The folks who paid for this are a little bit more conservative, perhaps, than the city as a whole. And what's going to end up happening here is it's going to be a very liberal, dare I say, Berkeley City Council, all but. Not quite, but all but. This is going to be a much further left council based on the folks.
And that would result in what? I ask again.
You're going to have a much.
How could Seattle get more liberal?
It would be hard, but we will work on it.
A $20 minimum wage?
Income inequality is going to be the types like income inequality. You have these meta social issues are going to be, I think, at more of the fore.
We already have a $15 wage on the way. What else? Rent control is illegal statewide, right?
Right.
So what could the city do?
Let me also say something that the other change in district elections is there's going to be a much more focus on retail politics. You're going to have constituents that are now, instead of right now, people don't know where to go if they want a traffic circle in their neighborhood, or if they're angry about, you know, their garbage collection or whatever. They don't really have a representative to go to. You hear the legislators all the time complaining that they get actually complaints from Seattle taxpayers because they don't really know where to go. What you're going to have is seven legislators that are very focused on delivering retail level services to their constituents.
Got it. So bottom line, more traffic circles. The Week in Review. We'll be back in what, CR? Yes?
Well,
did you have more?
I always have more. Let me just say that I mean, things could get more leftist. I mean, you could have paid sick leave that had 2 weeks to 3 weeks. You know, you could have more money for affordable housing, transportation, all the rest. I will say that I think two things are going to happen in the districts. One is you're going to get candidates like Jonathan talks about, the sort of leftist, in a way inspired by Shama Sawant and her victory, who will probably have an easier time under districts. But there's another kind of candidate that's going to happen too that I think will balance this out, which is you're actually going to get more NIMBY candidates, more reactionary candidates, more conservative, if you will, candidates. They're going to have an easier time in districts. The people you aren't going to get really in districts are your Sally Clarks. She is central casting for an at-large city council member, right? She's from nowhere. Who knows where she's from?
I know where she's from.
I went to college with her. She's from the UW.
From Southeast, but you wouldn't even know it. I mean, she kind of represented every neighborhood. She spoke Seattle fluently. That's not the kind of candidate you're going to get into districts. You're going to get more leftists and in a way, more NIMBY.
Okay, on the more NIMBY front, Ed Murray, the mayor of this city, when he wants to enact citywide policy, he needs 5 votes, right? Isn't that the right number? So this makes it harder to get 5 people who are focused on citywide things. You'll have more people focused on their neighborhood, the specific needs of a neighborhood rather than broader city policy. And there is your answer.
Okay.
Although Murray, as I point out, Murray is a master legislator. And Murray knows how to do transactional politics better than anybody else. So I think that the big winner of district elections is not the folks that the conservatives have funded it. It's not going to be actually the left crowd. It's going to be Ed Murray, because he's going to know how to trade the things that the district elected representatives want and get what he wants in return.
Okay, we're going to follow all of this as it actually plays out. It is going to be very interesting. Lots more to say. Before we take a break here, last week we told you, you were here, Joni, we told you about the new earthquake warning system.
Uh-oh, here it comes.
It's going to feel the first tremors, early tremors of an earthquake, and send out a message to your phone.
Earthquake. Earthquake. Moderate shaking expected in 5 seconds.
5 seconds, and we all tried to figure out what would we do with our 5 seconds. Well, it turns out you might not even have that much warning. This week, a magnitude 4.3 quake struck under the Cascades, where there's not a lot of seismic equipment, and the new warning system didn't notice it until 18 seconds afterward. So what would you do with that alert?
Earthquake. Earthquake. Moderate shaking expected in
18
seconds
ago. It already happened. At least you know it's time to tie up the phone lines to find out how everything went.
Well, I think this is one for Mike Baumgartner. He should work to get more sensors under the Cascades.
You are going to get false positives and late positives, but I think this is a great development. I mean, if this gets built out, it will save lives. It will save money. It has in Japan. I mean, 5 seconds, you can get under a table. You can put out a fire. I mean, fires erupt after these things because open flames get sort of.
You can grab the fire extinguishers.
You can get out of an elevator. You can stop your car. You can stop a light rail train. I mean, you know, there's 5, 10, certainly 15 seconds is a huge.
Or negative 18.
Negative 18 is tougher.
It is smaller amount of time.
You see the Conan O'Brien skit on this? What you do with your last 10 seconds on Earth? People were doing risque selfies. They were like stripping down naked and dancing in their office. They were.
All the things that have been pent up all this time, you know?
You know who's counting his last seconds on Earth?
The Mars guy.
The Mars guy that we met in the green room a few minutes. I swear he really is here, and he really is coming
in. He
hasn't
left yet.
And no, in just a few minutes, this is a Bellevue man who, unless has left, he is going to be, he's on the short list to go to Mars and never come back. And so we want to know what you want to know from him.
Right.
Yeah. So at KUOW, on Twitter or our Facebook page, and we'll relay your questions. Right back on the Week in Review with more top stories. Stay with us. And we'll get into that, Jonathan Martin and Joni Balter and C.R. Douglas. With you, our next top story before we go to Mars, the U.S. Secretary of Labor is really putting pressure on this labor dispute at West Coast ports. He says if the two sides don't reach an agreement today, they'll have to leave California and negotiate in Washington, D.C. You know how cold it is?
Six.
In Washington, D.C., this is hardball. Billions of dollars of cargo are sitting on ships anchored outside ports all down the West Coast. Jonathan, this will get settled eventually. So if you're not in the shipping business, why do you care how it comes out?
This is costing billions of dollars. The economic forecast for the first quarter of 2015 was dropped by a full 1% because of this. You think about that, the amount of money that's...
But you know how a cold snap depresses housing activity and then it comes back. Is this just going
to
be...
Talk to the apple growers in eastern Washington that are dumping apples into the canyons because they can't get their apples out of port.
In February? We're shipping apples.
Well, they have to get shipments
started.
No, food and meat is.
Well, that's
the
true.
Issue.
It's been going on for months.
Food
that's
and
true.
Meat is it, the it issue killed, because it's sitting offshore and it's just
and it'll rot.
It yeah. killed the Christmas tree harvest from Oregon and Washington. It's killing hay farmers right now. I mean, we are the most trade dependent state in the country, and what appears to be a real just insular union fight over apparently one arbitrator in L.A. is going to have a tremendous impact. In fact, I know that the economic forecast that's coming out today for the Washington state, which the state budget is based on, is apparently down significantly because so much tax revenue and economic activity has been lost because of this. It's a big deal.
It is a big deal, and it shows you how powerful the longshoremen are in an era where unions are on the wane. The longshoremen aren't. I mean, look at what they are holding up. They are holding up what half of the U.S. trade comes through West Coast ports. They have a lot of leverage here. These are folks that are well paid. They've gotten a lot of money over the years, and they're flexing their muscle.
Do you think that they'll send ships around the wider Panama Canal when the big ships are able to just go to the east?
Moment, they're trying not to do that. They're trying to get this thing settled by forcing them to huddle in the freezing Washington, D.C. is one thing. The longshoremen are royalty. I heard that earlier. That's a good line. They are royalty among all unions. And, you know, unions haven't been doing that well. This is symbolic as well as practical.
I just don't think when public support for unions is waning, I do not think this is a smart fight. Because really, you go back to what this is about, and according to Patty Murray yesterday and Tom Perez and people involved in these negotiations, really what the union is saying is they want the ability to fire one union arbiter that actually is a member of their own union and was picked by the union to be an dispute arbiter. They want to be able to fire him.
That's the irony. This isn't about wages.
No.
This isn't about health care. This isn't about benefits. This is about one guy who oversees labor disputes.
Yeah.
With respect to that Panama Canal, which is getting expanded, which will allow bigger ships to go through, there is a risk here that the unions, while they're flexing their muscle now, may come to regret this over time. I mean, West Coast ports have more and more competition. Vancouver, Mexico, and with the Panama Canal, Gulf and East Coast ports. I mean, over time, there will be shippers that won't want to deal with West Coast ports because of the labor unpredictability. They will go through the Panama Canal. I mean, most of the freight actually that comes through, for instance, Seattle, it doesn't even stay in Washington. I mean, it goes as far as Chicago. It can go down to Omaha. It can go to St. Louis. I mean, the freight goes way into the country, and there are other ways to get it to those places like the Gulf ports, like East Coast ports. So we got to be careful.
Yeah, but it's a longer journey, and so this is a calculated bet here right now.
And for the
not with the Panama Canal opening,
yeah,
that
for
really
the West Coast
things.
Ports, the other issue is that you have ships that are larger; they can fit through the Panama Canal, even the widened Panama Canal. So you're going to have less incentive to have ships have to go through the West Coast. You can have ships going to go around South America and go directly to the East Coast, which is a shorter rail distance. I mean, they're really gambling. This dispute is really gambling with the economic present and potentially the economic future of Washington State. Again, the most trade dependent state in the country. Because once you lose a market, it's very, very hard to get it back. And right now, they are burning a tremendous amount of goodwill with customers and markets in China and Japan and the Far East.
Okay. It's worth watching, and we will do that here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. How long until I get to talk to the Mars guy? Are we there?
Not that
really
long,
soon.
Man.
Really
not
soon.
That long.
Okay. Please make this break brief so we can meet the guy who may go to Mars in just a moment. KUOW's Week in Review. We've done it. We've arrived. First of all, we've done a great job running down what the top stories are this week. So there's that. Nice job, Sierra Douglas, Joni Balter, Jonathan Martin. And now a Bellevue man is on the short list, relatively short, to be one of the first humans to colonize Mars and never return to Earth. A private project, a nonprofit based in the Netherlands called Mars One, aims to establish a human colony on Mars by 2025. This week, they announced they've narrowed their applicant pool from 200,000 people to 100 people, and one of them is 28-year-old Microsoft programmer Carl LeCompte. Carl must have impressed the Mars One people with a video he sent them telling them why he should get to make this trip.
I'm at my best when building a home for myself and those around me. And all gimmicks aside, that's why I feel we're going to Mars. As much as to explore or to learn, we're going there to live.
That was Carl, who now has his headphones on because he's with us right now. Hiya, Carl.
Hey, how you doing?
He's in the KOW studio. Welcome. Congratulations, I think. If you are selected, Carl, what would you do on this Mars mission?
Specifically, I don't know yet. I mean, the mission is to go to colonize, to build a home. And why I say that is you have four people going in a single group, right? So you're going to have a tremendous amount of knowledge spread over this group of four people. You know, you need technical knowledge, you need doctors, you need psychologists.
And you are a physician. You are a physician and a lawyer, right?
No.
Oh.
That's why there's, 9 years of training.
Wow. So why do you think you're on the short list?
I think it's mainly attitude. I think it's because the desire to go there and to build a home there. Because that's what they're trying to do. You know, we're going there to stay and not come back. And that's...
But what are four people going to accomplish? What does that mean, go build a home? What would you... Do you have any idea what you would do? How do you colonize Mars?
Over time. That's the thing. This is sort of just a seed, right? Once you get people there, you have so many more options. Because, the Mars mission so far, Curiosity, Opportunity, things like that, part of it is there's... just the delay even in getting communications over there and the limited amount of things you have over there. Like you have this equipment that you sent and that's all you have. And, you can tell it what to do, but even telling it what to do is difficult because of the time delay in communications. But once you have people over there, you have, someone who can work, who can adapt, who can, hey, we need you to do this slightly different thing or this, that, or
and you
the
can't
other.
Turn us down because you have no other option.
It's not like you can get another job.
And by the way, these Mars colonizers are never coming back. You're leaving your loved ones forever. I have a million questions. I'll bet my guests have questions for you. Let me just give a word to, let's go to our social media producer, Bon Huberman. We asked for listeners' questions. What's a question a listener had for Carl?
Nairi asked on Facebook, what is your biggest fear or concern about this mission?
Good question.
It's that if something goes wrong, especially if it's, very, very public, I don't want it to discourage future missions. I'm not really afraid for myself or what happened to me,
Why not?
Because if we do this, even if we fail, we tried. And I think that's important, mm-hmm. right? And I think we should keep trying until we succeed. And I want us to keep trying until we succeed. And I hope nothing happens to discourage that.
Can I ask you what your mother said to you about this?
Don't go.
And you said?
We've basically come to an agreement that she's not going to convince me and I'm not going to convince her. So
I assume you're kind of an independent guy and don't need a ton of social activity. is that true? You would not want to do this if you loved hanging around a bunch of people.
Yeah, it's independent to a certain degree, right? Like, I'm the type who I have my group of people. I have my solo group of people who I'm very, very close to who, I'll spend a lot of time with these people. But I'm not, the social butterfly. Like, I don't like large groups and things like that. And that's part of the reason to me, a lot of people say, you're going up there, you're going to be cooped up with four people, for long periods of time. Like, that sounds horrible.
That sounds incredibly social. Social than you might want.
Well, that's the thing. To me, that sounds perfect. It's four people who have been explicitly chosen because they get along along well, who have been trained together, who have, you know, you've confirmed over 9 years that you've worked really well
together. It's KOW's Week in Review, basically. It's four people trapped in a room with each other who make the best of it. How long do you expect to live?
And that's a, you know, who knows, right? Like, as long as we can.
But it could be.
Hopefully full human life. And actually, an interesting point was made is, you know, we're going up there. We're going to have less gravity to, you know, strain the you know, heart cardiovascular system. We're going to be eating literally the healthiest food you can get because you don't want any waste with that sort of thing. We're going to be very active, so there's going to be a lot of exercise.
So, you're an optimist.
I mean, that's the thing. Unless something goes wrong, you know, we could live very long.
Jonathan.
So there's two men, two women. What's the dating scene in Mars?
Wow.
We'll find out.
What if you get a girlfriend before then, or if you have one?
I'm sort of going into anything at this point with a, you know what, I'm not passing anything by, but anything at this point has the caveat of, yeah, I might be, you know, leaving the planet in 10 years. So.
Yeah. That's second date. Say that for the second date. Here's, I want to ask you, before we run out of time, I just want to beg you not to go, okay? Because I'm worried about the worst case scenario. I hope it goes great. I love the imagination. You're clear that you're optimistic. You'd make the best of it. But you would be working for an employer who controls your food, your oxygen, your working conditions, your communications with Earth. You're powerless. You can't quit. You can't leave. What if your adventure is mining Mars for metals to make iPhones and you hate it and it's cold and boring? You know, I'm just worried for you. You're looking so on the bright side. I'm looking on the dark side of the Mars. Don't go, Carl. Stay.
I think we've already seen that science fiction movie there.
Have you thought of that? Or am I just depressing you?
Well, no, it's even then, you know, even if we end up going up to exploit Mars, which I don't think will happen. I certainly hope doesn't happen. Colonizing and, you know, expanding human influence, I still think is a worthy goal. So, you know, if that's what it takes to convince people to want to go, you know, we need to ship metals back, and that's how you convince people to go, and that's not going to happen for a long, long time because that's going to take a tremendous amount of infrastructure. But beside the point, it's still worth moving on and moving out.
We are out of time, and I hope you're not. Carl LeCompte, thank you so much. Microsoft programmer, Bellevue man on the short list, short-ish, to go to Mars and stay. Good luck. Whatever happens, I beg you don't go. But good luck.
Thank you.
C.R. Douglas and Joni Balter and Jonathan Martin from Q13 Fox and the Seattle Times and Seattle Channel. Thank you so much. Oh, and one more little note to pass on. Seahawks receiver Doug Baldwin this week apologized for its touchdown celebration during the Super Bowl in which he pretended to drop his pants and poop on the football. He says there was competitive stuff going on, and I just let out what I felt personally. Carl, can I come with you on second thought? Please, can we all come with you?
Well, they're going to have more applications, so.
Producer Jason Pagano, social media producer Bon Huberman, thank you all. We'll join you next week for the Week in Review.